You know, if he can't meet Rio Hanlon, the writer, the author, and somebody who's seeped in, talent and writing, and he gives you plenty of reason to disagree with him, I'll tell you that much, and we would know that as friends for decades. All right, Mr. Dublin, Sonny Knowles, I know you're wiping it. I know you're wiping a tear from your eye there, but that's all right. That's first of all, I'd like to let our listeners know that your latest book, Unintended Consequences, is a treasure, and I think. Again, you have obviously written about and written columns for publications throughout the world, but your story on immigration and immigration over the last 100 years is something akin to. How we as Irish would prefer, sometimes we don't want to talk about the famine, we don't want to talk about anything of, we don't want to talk about partition in Ireland, we don't want to talk about whether it has a module of truth or not, about the image of the Irish and we're drinkers and fighters and whatever. But I think for us who have been here, we're half ashamed, really, of the fact that America and that the connection between America and Ireland was such that, America put a blanket, closed the door, on the Irish, and you take us through that period, as again, some of us don't want to hear it, but it's true. Can you take us just back to 1965, and how the Irish, all of a sudden, gem of America, how they got shut out?
Mm. Well, thank you, Adrian. And before I get into that, just let me congratulate you on your receiving of a Presidential Distinguished Service Award from President Michael D. Higgins, I believe, sometime in the coming days. Richly deserved. Your work over the years set the seal on so many things, including in immigration, and readers of Unintended Consequences will learn of your role, literally your frontline role in securing many, many visas for the Irish at a time when it was virtually impossible to get in here under ordinary circumstances. So just let me put that down for the record before I
thank you.
Follow. Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to let you carry on and on there because I'm coming out, all right. let me ask you, though, because I think a lot of people, even those of us who knew at the time and have known since, can you just address what is it, in our makeup, in our genes that would prefer not to even refer to thing, put that in the past and let's just present and continue to present the bright side up,
I don't think that's a trait that's necessarily confined to the Irish. There is a
we're better
a
at
sort
it.
Of an urge. We're good at it, don't make a fuss. I remember that in my early days in America when the story of the undocumented Irish at that time was just coming to the fore, and I was writing about it for myself, actually mostly for the Irish press back in Dublin. But there was a definite sort of thing. Irish Americans were aware of the fact there were a lot of young Irish on American soil trying to sort of establish themselves but not being able to do so. And there was a definite sort of sense that, look, you know, don't make a fuss, don't make noise. We'll look after them. We'll get them jobs, which was well-intentioned. But it wasn't something that would secure a legal future for all these young Irish at the time. It was a sort of what can we do? And it was something that was certainly possible. We can help them get work and survive literally hand to mouth. But there was a definite sort of, you know, listen, if you make too much noise, they'll be noticed and they'll be in trouble. Well, they were in trouble anyway, just trying to sort of, you know, get through life every day here in a way that would sort of mean that they'd be here tomorrow. And eventually that kind of was kind of, I think Irish America realized that you couldn't keep going on that basis forever, that you had to sort of say, look, we have to do something. We have to get them legal status. And that resulted in the various campaigns that secured Donnelly and Morrison visas and Berman visas and ultimately Schumer diversity visas and so forth and so on. But you're right. I mean, I think we all like to think, oh, well, it might just go away. I think we're hoping the same with COVID, that damn thing would just go away. And if we turn our backs on it, again, you've got to face into the storm. So I think initially there was a reluctance to do that, certainly in the 1980s. But ultimately the storm was faced, and with some degree of success, but not total success, as you know.
That's for true. That's for sure. The bottom line is, how do we get into this bloody mess in the first place? And unintended consequences does. It captures that for us, but maybe for those who either don't know or choose to forget, bring us back, if you will.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, the situation that arose in the 1980s could be directly traced back two decades to the 1960s and the passage of the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. And the cover of the book shows the actual signing into law by President Johnson of that legislation on Liberty Island in New York on a balmy early October day in 1965. And, you know, as in my own work here, in my years working here, obviously I had direct contact and experience of the Irish Immigration and Reform Movement and later the Irish Lobby for Immigration Reform and various other groups, Chicago Celts, and of course the Ancient Order of Hibernians right through. But I was only vaguely aware of what had happened in the 1960s, and it was in more recent years that I became much more aware, thanks to the release of his memoir, his record of the time by Judge John Collins. When I read this, and then I was reminded that I had seen stories in archival copies of the Irish Echo going back to that time on the front page, and I had access to them of the 65 Act and the response of Irish America at the time. It was the formation of the American Irish National Immigration Committee and others, the Hibernians, who realized that the 65 Act, though it was not directly aimed at the Irish per se, or indeed other Europeans, but by ending sort of national quotas, which was, you know, morally the right thing to do, it would mean that the Irish of the time, who tended to immigrate as individuals, would not do well under a new process which favored family reunification. So, in other words, entire families. If that 65 legislation had been applied during the Great Hunger years, for example, when entire Irish families were desperately scrambling across the Atlantic to survive, it wouldn't have been a problem. But by the mid-1960s, when you looked at Irish immigration, there was relatively few family units making the move across the ocean. It was individuals, and they would get caught out by this new law. And the visa, the priority of visas would go to relatives of people already here and so forth. And so very quickly it became apparent the 65 law had a 3-year sort of break-in period. So by 1968, it was fully enforced, and the statistics were pretty staggering. The Irish literally fell over a cliff in terms of visa numbers. But this wasn't the intention of those who crafted that legislation, including Ted Kennedy, hence the unintended consequences. But they were certainly very significant consequences, nevertheless.
You know, my guest, Ray O'Hanlon, and his newest book, Unintended Consequences. I want to ask you, though, even those who were, you know, you mentioned Ted Kennedy, but those who practically revered John F. Kennedy would be kind of, should we say, covering up at least the story that, you know, if John F. Kennedy, president of Ireland, didn't go over and you know, in a closed room, be told that you know, we love America and all right, but God, you're stealing the best of what Ireland is producing. I mean, here we are, and we're educating them, we're preparing them, you know, for life. And then America says, okay, come on over, we can use you now. There was so much, again, after the fact, a decade later, people started to say, what the hell would John F. Kennedy, President John F., go to Ireland and be influenced, you know, by those who are saying, you know, enough, we're doing all right now, thank you. And it would be, you know, a nice thing now if you would stop the brain drain and let us, you know, we're doing all right, thank you. All right. What get to the guts of that one, those who accept it and those who say, maybe it's true.
Yeah, I mean, there was there was a pull both ways at the time. Obviously, there was a desire in the 1960s. Ireland was beginning to come out of its sort of economic torpor, and there were plans for developing the economy and a desire on the part of successive governments to keep Irish people in Ireland. And it, very hard to stop them going to England, for example, because they just had free access. There was no ands, ifs, or buts. But there was certainly a means of sort of preventing a significant flow westward across the Atlantic, because you did have to jump through hoops to get into America. And when John F. Kennedy, I mean, he wrote in A Nation of Immigrants, he had this vision of a future immigration system, as I said, that would depend very heavily on family reunification. Again, it wasn't his intention to stop the Irish. I think he believed that, you know, the Irish would still come. There was a sort of a misunderstanding, a sort of a time lapse in a way. Legislators in Washington didn't, I don't think they really, you know, okay, we're going to stop national quotas and that's a good thing from Western Europe and everything else. But I don't know if they quite did their homework on what immigration from Western Europe was like in that time. I think they just looked at numbers. And certainly with regards to the Irish, there was a desire and there were offers made. I mean, Teddy Kennedy and sort of certainly said to the Irish at the time, look, you know, we can set something aside here for you and build something in that allows you. But in fairness to Kennedy, but the reaction from the Irish government was, no, we want to keep. And it was very understandable. We want to keep our young people here because we want to develop Ireland's economy. It's hard to argue with that. But what is also sort of clearly visible is that even with that development of the Irish economy to some extent, it was never going to be so big that it could give everybody a job in Ireland then.
Yeah.
In those times, in the 60s and certainly the 70s, there would still be a sort of a pool of people in Ireland, and those with connections to America who would say, oh, you know, looking westward, I can do better in America. And I might only go for a year or two, but of course that was very often not the case, but they couldn't go. So it was like there wasn't enough economic development on the one hand, and there was no access to America on the other hand. So you had a sort of a double negative situation, really. You know, as I said, the consequences are felt to this day. You know, in terms of obviously the undocumented Irish who are here, because the 65 Act really laid the groundwork for, you know, the situation where we face now with millions and millions of undocumented people in the United States. You can trace it back to the 65 Act. Yeah. There were unintended consequences for every nationality, not just the Irish. The Irish in this book are really kind of like the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
And you look at the Irish and very specifically, but, you know, the other nationalities, so, you know, sort of, but not as much as the Irish because, you know, by the 1960s, the 60s, there weren't that many Scandinavians or Germans coming this way, but there were still quite a few, still a lot of Irish because of the very established nature of Irish America. This was another home. You weren't entering a strange land devoid of you were meeting people with names similar to yours anywhere, you know, and certainly in certain big cities. So, you know, it ended up echoing down the years to this very day. And, you know, we're still sort of dealing with, you know, the reverberations of that time.
We would have to admit, though, that at that period, and indeed, you know, many, many times since, that somehow any laws that are made, you know, there are exceptions. And we are and have been traditionally such a part of the success of America that maybe, you know, it's easy for us to say, well, you know, want to know something. Yeah, it applied to all of the countries of Western Europe. But I'll tell you one thing, that really doesn't apply to us. We'd be the exception because God knows, you know, we've earned it. Is that something that still exists? You know, today, I know that for those of us who were here during that period, we thought, again, you know, you'd mentioned about all the Irish undocumented that were all around us. I mean, it didn't take, you know, the CIA to, you know, to investigate. It was there, but it was accepted because, you know, we weren't slouches. We weren't living off, you know, welfare. We weren't looking for a free ride. We were here, and by God, we're going to, you know. So any laws that are there, you know, unintended consequences, which O'Hanlon is exposing now. Well, you know, we didn't take them seriously. We thought, hey, we're going to be safe one way or the other. Listen, for God's sake, this country would collapse if it weren't for the Irish. Is that a strength or a weakness, or am I exaggerating the significance?
Well, it can be. Yeah, it's kind of both. I mean, I think that if you didn't sort of feel that somehow you were special or distinguished, or that you had earned something, as the Irish feel, they have definitely earned something in America. And then face a sort of a closed door. I don't think you'd necessarily get up and actually do something about it. The feeling that the Irish have contributed so much to America, and that is an accurate feeling, is a kind of a springboard for action. But after that, what you come up to, you know, yes, we were standouts. We're the second largest European ethnic group in the United States after the Germans. America is very heavily an Irish nation. But that is the springboard for the initial action. But then you sort of have to look around and realize, okay, but we're not the only country involved here. There are people from all over the world who see America as their future. And it's a shared future. We can't necessarily expect individual special treatment. in going forward in the future. So hence, I think the realization among immigration reform activists that the Irish have to be in the mix with everybody else. It has to be a sort of a broad-based alliance. And if it's successful, the Irish will gain from it, but they'll gain their proportional share a reasonable share. But it's something that has to be sort of worked out with many other sort of nationally linked groups.
And at that time, I think what was shocking to the established Irish American community those who were involved in establishing the Irish immigration reform movement, that many people said, wait a minute, I mean, these cheeky people who are over here doing absolutely fine, they don't even have green cards themselves. They're bold enough to go out there and to say, all right, if we'll do this ourselves. If we get any help, that's fine. If we don't, well, we'll do it anyway. Wasn't that... some people did feel, though, and it was amazing, if you go to the Echo, if you go to any of the Irish American media outlets there, that it was kind of something. We came in with the Cromwellian approach to it, say, hey, if you think that we're going to settle for this, we're not. And who are you again? I'm an undocumented immigrant from Ireland. Oh, jeez. There was a little bit of that as well. But again, when you talk about the Irish immigration reform movement, the Irish immigration centres at the time and since, it was a bold move for people who were defying and marching out in the street and saying, hey, this is not right.
And one of the first things they had to do, actually, was to educate quite a few Irish Americans with regards to the reason why they were undocumented. There was a, for those who weren't paying 100% attention to it, there was a bit of a kickback from some Irish-born people in the United States, sort of feeling, well, look, I came here legally. I went to all the rules and did this and why can't these? And then the IIRM and others did a very good job of then explaining to this broader Irish public opinion, Irish-American public opinion, as to why these young people were outside the law. It wasn't their choosing. They didn't want to be outside the law. They were coming up against barriers that hadn't existed. If you go back, to the 1950s, the last big sort of arrival of Irish that didn't exist in your day, or even into the first half of the 1960s, were having to deal with things you didn't have to deal with. We don't want to be undocumented. This is not our choice. And even if, maybe I'm working off the books and not paying taxes, but I'd rather pay taxes, quite frankly, and have a green card and be able to fly home to see my family for a holiday and so forth and so on. So part of the IIRM's mission, I think, in those early days was to win over the hearts and minds of the Irish here who may not have been fully informed as to the details behind the predicament of so many young Irish people at the time.
Ray O'Hanlon, I would like to switch gears here because we chat quite often as friends and about topics other than those addressed in Unintended Consequences. But you did something that many of us kind of had on this imaginary bucket list in being in America and, making a living, having families and whatever. But there are many people who say, you know what I want to do? I want to see more of America. I'd like to be able to, you know, visit or spend some time, you know, in different parts of America. And then time comes and it goes, and yeah, we can do drop-ins to places. But you and your wife, Lisa, in the midst of, you know, a pandemic, in the midst of a period of uncertainty, you did something that was in your minds from day one, and you actually got behind the wheel of, you know, I don't know what you would call it, a camper or whatever.
Yep.
And you took off. And you did an amazing amount of work. Here you are. It didn't stop your writing. It didn't stop your creativity. No. You were able to, you know, produce the Irish Echo each week. And you were in vague places that we couldn't find on the map. Tell us about, first of all, the motivation and where the guts came from to say, look, we want to do this. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah, and it took guts, because I was absolutely terrified of the prospect of this before we did it. But you mentioned my wife, Lisa. Lisa is from the Midwest. She's from Illinois. She's from Danville, Illinois, and then later Chicago. And she remembers, you know, in her youth, sort of camping trips with her parents from Illinois up to Wisconsin and Michigan and stuff like that. So that's in her DNA. And she retired this year from a career lifetime in teaching. And as you know, the thing about teaching is that you get good holidays, but they're very set piece at certain times of the year. So she had this idea that we would get ourselves a camper and we'd go wandering off into America. And I mean, you know, this was, of course, in the middle of COVID. And what COVID had taught us was that, and we had to work remotely. The Irish Echo office basically closed down in March 2020, like with the rest of New York.
Yeah.
And off we all came home. And for months afterwards, we were both working from home, and I was bringing out, learning that, you know, that you can bring out a newspaper from anywhere as long as you've got the technology and the connections and everything else.
Yeah.
And that sort of stuck in the head when we came up with the idea of this camper trip across America, which began in September, ordinarily a time when Lisa would be going back to school.
Mm-hmm.
So in September of October, just gone, over a period of 5 weeks, we hitched this camper to a Ford Explorer, which was heavy enough to pull it. It's not a big camper. It's about 18 feet long. It's called a Boondock Teardrop. It's not a massive camper, and you do see massive campers, but it's enough for two, and our dog Riley, who came with us and is a very good traveler. And we set off west because our son Jack, who qualified in college, graduated last year, was working in Montana for the Montana Conservation Corps. He was in the wilderness, sort of clearing trails and painting firehouses and doing good work. And we decided, let's go see him. But of course, there was a lot of land in between us and him and around. And we ended up over 5 weeks traveling through 24 states. I think because we did all sorts of side excursions, I think we drove close to 8,000 miles. With this thing hitched up in the back and learning all the way about the intricacies of camping, you know, which, as I say, terrified me at the start, but bit by bit, we began to learn, the ropes. And at the end, I guess we are now relatively experienced, but it was an extraordinary, trip into America. I mean, I've always, I don't know, coming from a small island where, you know, 20 miles is a long trip. I've always looked at America with its endless roads. I like long distance driving, and you know, being in places like Montana and Utah and New Mexico and you know, like 100 miles of nothing, just sort of driving and seeing. And we met great people and saw extraordinary places. Really, I mean, it's all out there. I mean, America the beautiful. Yes, it absolutely is. It's also America the huge, and sometimes on some days America the endless. But it was an absolutely challenging exhilarating, invigorating, sometimes scary. A close encounter with a rattlesnake at one point in Montana.
Geez, I hope you didn't bring him back with you.
No, we left him on the prairie. But it really was. As I say, I've always been an Americaphile. And I figured if I'm going to live here, I want to see it, all of it. I'm up to 48 states, only two more to go. And that's Oregon and Alaska. And hopefully by the time I take my leave, I will have notched up to 50. 32 counties in Ireland and 50 states in America.
My God.
It was incredible. We met incredible people. Campsites are very interesting, microcosms of America. It was an interesting experience seeing Americans doing what they do, because we were tourists, and I think a minority of the people that we saw, I met with, were tourists. A lot of them are in-state, people who might only live 50 miles away, but they have a camper and they go to a campsite for a weekend or a few days vacation. It was an incredible experience.
Most of us, even those who are reluctant to get absorbed in latest technology, would have to acknowledge, that the GPS system is great. You put in an address and you get there. Mm-hmm. Now, so you leave New York, you and Lisa leave New York, and you have one address that gave birth to the idea. You're going to go to Montana, you're going to see Jack, you're going to meet him and so forth. Now, was there an overall, GPS, God bless it, isn't going to help you when you're setting out. Hey, did you know you were going to go for 5 weeks? Had you planned? Had you plotted? Or did you just put it?
Certainly four. It ended up being five. There was a certain amount of planning and then a certain amount of make it up as you go along. There were some days where we'd set off in the morning and we didn't know where we were staying at night. Lisa would be on the phone booking campsites and generally navigating. We also had a road atlas as well, which we can still. We always say that kids these days can't use maps, and we can. And we like looking at it. It's nice to look at because it sets everything in perspective, where you are in relation to other things. And so we had sort of a rough plan, and we did visit friends along the way in Wisconsin, in Utah, in Colorado, and some over on the east side. I mean, we went in this great big loop. We went across, from New York across the Midwest and took a sharp turn north in Chicago up to Wisconsin, Minnesota, across Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana. We were quite a few days in Montana, obviously. And then we were down in Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, and then across back to Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Mississippi, through Alabama into Georgia, visited my father-in-law outside Atlanta, North Carolina, and back up into Maryland, the southern tip of Maryland. There's a place called Assateague. It's a national seashore, beautiful, wonderful place. Nothing there, wild ponies, and you can park your camper. And you're aware of what a nice beach is like now for a good walk. that was at the end of the trip, and then the first night was spent in Pennsylvania, and the last night was spent camping in Delaware, and all points in between. It was along the way, magnificent national parks. You can get national park passes, and you can, because it's quite expensive to drive in there, but Glacier, Yellowstone, Tetons, Teddy Roosevelt's parks, we saw so much, and yet even then, there's so much more. There were roads that we came to within 10 miles of running out of gas on one stretch in Montana. Because pulling this thing, the gas mileage was pretty horrendously bad, so you had to be always on your hard looking at the gas gauge.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was, as I say, it was, I wouldn't describe it as a holiday in the sense, if you climb Mount Everest, do you call that a holiday? No, you call that an incredible adventure. Yeah. And it wasn't climbing Mount Everest, but it was an incredible adventure with holiday moments. But it was also, you had to apply yourself to it.
Yeah.
As well.
Now, when you know, you had mentioned there that Lisa is spent a lot of time on the phone because you had to have, it's great to have a camper and so forth, but you do need to get a secure and, you know, a campsite that has a good reputation, or is that the case at all? Do you know when you're going to a campsite, is this one of the recommended ones, or do you assume?
They come in various shapes and forms. Sometimes we stayed in state parks, and they would have very rigorous standards. Sometimes we stayed in KOA campgrounds of America campgrounds, and they would have vigorous standards. A lot of them were privately run, and they were all fine. They varied in price a bit. You know, Jackson Hole, Wyoming was expensive, but the place just outside Little Rock, Arkansas, which was very interesting, that was the cheapest of the night. But that was one place that reminded us, because we'd seen that excellent movie Nomadland with Frances McDormand, and the owner of the campsite outside Little Rock. We were just asking her, you know, what's the story here? She was a very nice woman. And basically most of the people in that campsite lived there.
Yeah.
And there are campsites like that, which are basically mobile home parks where people live or live temporarily if they have a short-term job in the area. So we were about the only tourists in that place that night.
Yeah.
That was a particular type. Most of them were people who would be doing recreational camping, but very often not all that far from where they lived.
Mm.
They weren't traveling hundreds of miles. They were traveling maybe dozens of miles. But this was the weekend getaway, and there were a lot of people on the road. There are a lot of people on the road in America right now for various reasons. And one night, I mean, I think the record was we were on the road. As we came back east, things started to get more crowded. Yeah. And I think I remember Lisa saying, that's the 10th. We finally have a place to stay tonight, and that's the 10th place I've tried. So she'd ring them up, and they'd say, sorry, we're full up. You know, and you sort of wonder.
I know,
We were going to get any place, or we're going to just do it on the side of the road, which is always a possibility, but boondocking. But we never had to do that. But certainly there were some days when it took a fair bit of work to actually get, you know, a destination for the end of the day.
Now, for those who are seasoned campers or indeed, you know, mobile homes that are no longer mobile, they're sitting there and people just love by happenstance to go to a place. How is, when you pull in, is there a, do you think people are sizing you up?
They are sizing you up.
Yeah.
And I mean, the one thing about this particular camper we had was a single axle, and reversing it into, you know, if you could pull through, which is I was always very relieved to hear, you can pull through. It means you go in front ways and just park.
Yeah.
But if you have to reverse in, this thing turns on a dime. It jackknifes very easily because it's on a single axle. So what you try to do would be pull out straight and go back reverse straight, which was somewhat easier, but you could, it was certainly a character builder, because if you were having difficulties parking, you knew there were, you know, eyes on you, and they were sort of rolling their eyes. At the same time, I'll have to say, and this was, campers were extraordinarily ready and willing to help you in any way, shape, or form. If they saw you as being tenderfoots, you know, inexperienced, there was no shortage of advice or help. If you had a problem, you just, you know, I have a problem with my hitch, just stick up your hand and say, I have a problem with my hitch. There'll be 10 guys around in a minute.
Amazing.
You know, all sort of advising and working and sometimes doing it for you. There's a sort of a camaraderie. And as I say, they spot learners very quickly, but they are, you know, our experience was folks were always ready and willing. I looked at campsites, and we talk about all the trouble that America has with itself today and political divisions and this, that, and everything else. Everybody should go live in a campsite, up close and personal, and realize, you know, we're all in the same boat. And the amazing thing was that, you know, people sort of buck against regulation here, people giving out about regulations. I've never seen anything so regulated as campsites. They have their rules, and everybody obeys them. No ands, ifs, or buts. And so it's a great sociological lesson as well, yeah, in a way, that you live cheek by jowl in a circumstance that cooperation is the way forward. And, you know, if you can do it yourself, that's fine, and it relieves everybody else with their own devices. But if you need help, then just put up your hand and say, look, I need help. You got a posse immediately, already and willing.
That's
so
great.
I find it very interesting. It's a study, as I say. Campers would be interesting interviewees to talk to them about stuff like this.
Yeah. I want to come back to your book because, you know, some people are born writers and some people stumble into careers. But going back to...
I wanted to be a pilot. I kind of stumbled into journalism, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, if you just take your experiences of backing in without into a campsite without taking somebody out, I was thinking there when you were telling me everybody is so willing to help you, you know, maybe they looked at it the way you were backing, you know, you're a camper there, and very few of them might say, Jesus, this guy would make a great pilot. You know, it's great and it's very interesting indeed to actually talk to somebody who has done it. You know, many of us would say, you know, that's something we need to do. And actually, Lisa yourself and Riley just got up and did it. I wonder if I'm, you know, your writing, you started... on, you know, back in 1988, a multi-award-winning book, you know, The New Irish Americans. Now, was that your first book, or is that the first one you want to brag about?
No, that was my first book, and I think at that time it was because... I mean, I've written three books myself now, but my name is on or in about a half dozen other books that have come out over the years, and including Being New York, Being Irish, the book that came out with NYU, Glucksman, Ireland House, for example, various other books that are team written by groups over the years. There's a half dozen of those or so, but I really only count the ones that I do solo. And The New Irish Americans, The South Lawn Plot, which of course is fiction, and thriller and novel, and now Unintended Consequences. They're the ones that are the authorship ones. The New Irish Americans was, I was kind of 10 years on the job here, and I said, well, you know, you could actually, what have I learned here? What have I seen? This was an unplanned life. In many ways, like for a lot of Irish people, but this is certainly an overall story here. And that book was a combination of immigration, but also the politics and the social thing of the time, the Clinton adventure in Ireland and all that sort of stuff. So that was like it was multi pronged. I mean, Unintended Consequences is focused entirely on the immigration issue, so they are distinct books in that regard.
As an editor, as a writer, as somebody who has to keep up with news every single solitary day, was it a relief for you to tackle a novel? The South Lawn. This is O'Hanlon without reins. You can do whatever
completely.
The hell you want here.
Exactly. Well, within reason.
I know.
Completely off the rails. It has to be believable, even if it's unbelievable. It's very different, and it is a release in many ways because, you know, you write something like Unintended Consequences, you're constantly referring to the record. to, you know, all sorts of things that you have to sort of base. You know, sometimes you can interpret or analyze or make an opinion maybe based up, but it's always on the facts. Whereas in a novel, certainly you're in, it's a very different sort of discipline. And you can just sort of, make it up as you go along. But again, you have to sort of make sure it's within reason and it can't be completely, you know, off the rails. So it was, I've started another novel now, sort of a semi-follow-up to the South Lawn plot, and it's called the St. Helena plot, and Napoleon is in the mix, and I have to sort of jizz up my energy to, you know, when you're writing a book, and it doesn't, and that isn't necessarily the case when you start doing the thing. Often you start and you put it aside and you come back to it, and that's what I've done.
Mm.
And I'm hoping in 2022 to come back to the St. Helena plot and actually do the thing and sort of get it
in
done.
In the meantime, I think it probably applies to all of us in media, in writing, is that those who like or tolerate, you know, what you do and what you say, think that perhaps the left-handed compliment that again we're very good at as Irish. Sometimes we say, you know, I love your program, but you didn't play Four Green Fields. You know, that type of thing. Are there people who will pick one singular idea, chapter, a paragraph that will say, that's it, and then you have to wonder, well, did they just pick a paragraph or whatever?
Yeah.
You need thick skin at times, and then that's a left-handed compliment, but, you know.
No, I take left-handed. I am left-handed, so I take left-handed compliments easily. You know, I mean, yeah, of course, there's always people, well, you didn't put in this in and put that in. I mean, and I say to them, well, you're almost like an editor in a way, and a reverse. Yeah. You're spotting an absence and everything else, and fair play to you. But, you know, the one thing about writing the book these days, if it's going to be in physical form, is you've got a publisher looking over your shoulder all the time, muttering about the word count. You know, it can't go on. I managed to write this a little bit longer than the publisher envisaged initially. But they accepted it because they could see the rationales for it. So, yeah, of course, there's always... But I always take that as a healthy sign because people are bothering, you know.
Interested.
Complete and utter silence is what would worry me. I'll take complaints, Anita.
Good. Well, that's it. And if you ever run short of any, you can come over here. We have a batch of them. On an ongoing basis. Listen, thank you for spending the time with us, and again, this is great. You know, you have the writer's disease anyway. When is enough enough? We just listened to Kevin O'Connor there, talking about Charlie Haughey, and a writer doesn't know when enough is enough. It's in you, and that's it. And you know, you have a family. You have Lisa. Even I'm sure Riley is saying, "What the hell is he doing now?" I mean, shouldn't there be an interval someday? There isn't.
No, not really. I mean, less might be enough in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to be able to continue as a newspaper editor forever. But even if you know it comes that I'm no longer directly involved in editing The Echo, I think writing certainly will always be there. It may be just more, I suppose, more books. But yeah, you're never going to completely get away from writing. But you know, less perhaps, and then more time for. I mean, even on the camping trip, as I said, I had my laptop with me. I was working. This was a working holiday. You know, it's the way of our times. You talk about the writer's disease. I don't think I've quite got the disease, though. I may have a slight infection, but it's not. I think I'll reach a point where I'll be able to only do what I want to do. You know.
Good luck to you, And yeah, thanks. It's great. It's great to have a career where actually you're not doing it strictly to make a living, but if you can get a career that you're passionate about and then figure a way to pay for it as you go along, that's a gift, not you know, afforded to everybody. Listen, my friend, good luck, Unintended Consequences, and it's by Ray O'Hanlon. Publisher?
Marion Press in Ireland.
Oh, Marion.
Yeah, Marion in Ireland, but also published in Chicago, National Book Network distribution, out of printing distribution. This is a unique project, and I should mention here, I think I have before, that this expanded printing and publication was aided by the Irish Institute and Tara Circle, who generously supplied funds for this project. It went to the publishers, not to me, it has to be said, but with their help, we were able to sort of both publish in Ireland and in the United States, which I think is absolutely appropriate given the story. So both those organizations should be lauded for their help.
Okay. Ray O'Hanlon, again, friends, just in case you didn't get it the first 15 times, we've mentioned it here, Unintended Consequences, well worth a read. And again, always a pleasure, to have somebody who's with such dedication. And again, by the way, off air, I'm going to have a word with your wife, Lisa, and say, you know, did you ever tell him, put that bloody pen down and leave it down? You know.
Yes.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you, Adrian. Congratulations again on your award.
Thank you. Thank you, indeed. And friends, bye-bye. That brings us to the end of a program.